Latimer today at 4. I've been wondering at the incredible calm that has come over me the last 2 days, and the only explanation I have is that I'm drawing strength from all of you working at Claymont and the Imaginal. So grateful.
Wow.
And Marcella wrote to us all on Facebook, Cynthia and all at Claymont, there is a great stilling that is emanating out of your gathering this week as I tune in. Powerful, profound, very much an active, solid stilling happening in the now. It is a moving and ever-increasing stilling needed. Joining in. So very, very grateful.
Great. Yeah, it's been striking me that there are a few people out in the network that have been following this in their own intuitive hearts, you know, and a few of them have been grabbing Bob's been putting up the raw audios of the day's proceedings. But a few people have clearly been tracking this in their own space, and I'm struck and really surprised that what they seem to be saying unanimously is this dimension of stillness and calm, which is, you know, certainly not how it feels inside it, but it's amazing how it's on the outside that's that. So before we do anything else this evening, and before we decide, before the group decides which way this is going to roll, I wanted to maybe sound and initial dough for the evening that will hang some things on, including these miraculous bows that will be explained shortly, but I think they'll make some more sense in the context of what I want to start out with. We talked a little bit yesterday about conscience and remorse of conscience, and Gurdjieff's beautiful and in some ways singular teaching about conscience being kind of the drive shaft that begins to open the way into the whole reconnection with the heart of our common Father and with in that sense what is truly right and just in the universe. So I could say that this is a singular teaching, but in a way it isn't. There's a whole body of teaching that many of us know kind of vicariously and out on the side that was exploring much this same turf, and which I think is still a good reservoir of this as we cross-reference this striking teaching in Beelzebub with some known reference points. And that comes from the Quaker tradition. And many have heard a little bit about Quakerism, about, you know, they have this thing about the light of God shining in each person, and they think, isn't this cute? You know, we've all got this designed Tinkerbell of goodness and purity shining in us. But when you start reading the texts, it's not like that at all. The light within is more like the searchlight of conscience. And the way the Quakers worked with this, and I think this is really key to us about how we proceed as we go forward, the way they worked with it was to teach people first and foremost not to run from the light and not to expect that the light is going to be pleasant and affirming, that it's going to make you writhe. And what happens in your transformation begins on the other side of that writhing. Because it's a process of really surrendering your immediate comfort zone, your sense of value, your self-calming, as Gurdjieff would call it, your ability to restore a happy, coherent, self-justified picture of who you are, let it go. And listen, because with the very light that conscience shines in your life, it's shining from a higher place in you, from a higher capacity in you. And while the experience is usually horrible empirically, it's actually sacred in terms of the final evolution. So the Quakers taught a practice over and over again of welcoming that light of conscience when it entered, standing still in it rather than running, submitting to it, and then allowing the real alchemy of that to begin to infuse into your life as newfound strength, newfound clarity, newfound resolve. But all of these are the fruits of standing still in the struggle, not running. It's simply another take on the same, almost the same paradigm that Gurdjieff is teaching, as far as I can see. But it's almost not recognized as this by any of the religious traditions, and certainly I think there are very few Gurdjieffians that have studied Quakerism or vice versa. But we were graced to have these things thrown together in us in this crazy little network that this wisdom network is, by the presence of Paulette Meyer, who set out to set some of these Quaker pith sayings to music. And she created a chant on the first album of the CDs that I want to call to your attention and actually share with you, because as we break camp tomorrow and go back into the, you know, our worlds, it's a really, really powerful piece to hang on to bring us back into coherence with the light, and also to rip from our eyes any illusions that the way we get there is by pleasant experiences. So she writes, and I forget who she's quoting it. I always say it's probably George Fox in the Light of Others. I'm sure that one of you've got this ready on your cell phone and can find out which quote this is. But it's one of her complicated chants. But the text goes, "Stand still in that which is pure after you see yourself. After thou seest thy thoughts and temptations, do not think, but submit." And then power comes in. Stand still in that which shows and discovers, for there doth strength immediately come. And stand still in the light and submit to it, and the other will be hushed and gone, and then contentment comes. So that standing still in the midst of that excruciating ground of being exposed in mid-backing out the door, you know, stand still, don't run. Allow that higher light to expose you. Notice what I said there, to expose you. Not to justify you, affirm you, confirm you, to expose you. And in that standing, a new quality comes. And this teaching lists four of those qualities. I'm trying to do the power, strength. Mercy, the first one. How could I have forgotten? Mercy, power, strength, contentment.
It's George Fox.
Thank you. 1652.
Ah,
good old George.
1652.
Yeah, I think so. So here's the chat. Many of you know this, but it's one of the things that I would propose to you for inner work in a nice packaged form. When you're working with this, when you chat it, when you remember it that way, you're going to be putting into your body the Gurdjieffian teaching on conscience and how it is accessed, maintained, and activated. And it could be said on the other end that the Quakers moved out from these encounters with a sure-footedness that still leaves the world in awe. Of all the world religions, they're probably the one that have closed the gap the most admirably between religious ideal and actually action by living your truth, by living into martyrdom for your truth, if it's necessary, with equanimity and joy and a trust in the unity of all worlds. So there's a strength here. People say, how did the Quakers do it? Modern Quakers don't do it anymore. Well, no, they stay there and count their money and live in the suburbs rather than working with this very core practice. So here's the chant. Some of you...
The whole quote first.
Pardon?
Do you mind? I'd like to read the whole quote.
Yeah.
Friends, whatever ye are addicted to, the tempter will come in that day. And when he can trouble you, then he gets advantage over you, and then you are gone. Stand still in that which is pure, after ye see yourselves, and then mercy comes in. After thou seest thy thoughts and the temptations, do not think, but submit, and then power comes. Stand still in that which shows and discovers, and then doth strength immediately come. And stand still in the light, and submit to it, and the others will be hushed and gone, and then content comes.
The teaching in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. Here's the song, and you can dig this up online. If you don't have the CD already, just Google Paulette Meyer, M-E-I-E-R, Timeless Quaker Wisdom in Plain Song Chat. It'll be right up. So.
Do you want the page plus?
I don't think I'm going to. No, I'm going to leave this. This is David's beautiful work, which he's going to show you in a minute. And you'll hear the song. We'll put the words back in a little while. Listen with your heart. Sing along if you know the song. Stand still in that which is pure, after ye see yourselves, and then mercy comes in. After thou seest thy thoughts and temptations, do not think, but submit, and then power comes in. Stand still in that which shows and discovers, for there doth strength immediately come. And sit still in the light, and submit to it, and the other will be hushed and gone, and then comes. Stand still in that which is pure, after ye see yourselves, and then mercy comes in. After thou seest thy thoughts and temptations, do not think, but submit, and then power comes in. Stand still in that which shows and discovers, for there doth strength immediately come. And stand still in the light, and submit to it, and the other will be touched and gone, and then contentment comes. our marching orders, I think, for personal work in the collective. I'm going to take it on that way. Seeing if we can actually reactivate in ourselves this being impulse of conscience for whatever use it may be at the planet. David, do share with us your work here.
When I go places, especially if I find them to be special places, I like to have a sacred object to take back with me. And I went into a formal garden and just was blown away by that. And I've been talking it up with Clancy, and I think I'll be back to keep working on that formal garden. And so I came to that, to especially the boxwoods, because my understanding is they come from Mount Vernon, so they go way back. And Andrew gave me an opportunity when he was clearing out a line of sight down all of the steps, and he was cutting out some fresh boughs. And so I'm offering this as your sacred object to take home. And there's a little piece of paper on there that I'll get to in just a second. And I want to thank Andrew for some guidance and help he gave me. And Amy, I want to thank you. And Laura, I want to thank you for your help. And Anne, where's Anne? Oh, there's Anne. Thank you. I've been working on this fruits of the spirit that Cynthia talked about several times in the Eye of the Heart. And in her previous book, Wisdom Way of Knowing, she called it qualities of aliveness. And then there's another name that's pretty familiar, the names of God. And I found a lot of these words in Wisdom Jesus as well. And then, because we're in Gurdjieffian territory, I also discovered these words in Jacob Needlesman's What is God? And there's just a hilarious chapter that culminates in qualities of aliveness or names of God that you've got to read if you haven't read that book. So what I would like for you to do is to write a word on this slip of paper. Write a fruit of the spirit that resonates with you from this week, or that feels is your essence. And here's the context for that. This page 146, Cosmic Dialysis, by far and away just is my favorite page in the whole book. And because it talks about our role, these are Cynthia's words. When you pave over a pasture to put in a shopping mall, you're not only removing nutrients from the ecosystem, but you also are putting in place psychic toxins, like in this case, the toxin of greed. And then on this page, she talked about a number of other toxins. But then she said, and I want to read this explicitly, the main ongoing work of the conscious circle is to reduce this psychic smog, and where possible, to rebalance it with a direct infusion of those other elements which we have been referring to as fruits of the spirit, namely love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. These two are powerful psychoenergetic nutrients for both the noosphere, gotta get sort of close, noosphere and the biosphere. In fact, in their absence, human habitation quickly becomes untenable. So there's a whole list of them here. So if you didn't, if one that was listed on this page that I just read didn't resonate with you, there's lots of others. I stood back here. I know that that Carla cannot see this list, but she can get up and look at it. Do this at your leisure. Try to do it before you leave, is to write on your piece of paper, and it's big enough that you could write a little note on there as well.
So you need to put patience under eye of the heart in green.
Patience?
Mm-hmm.
It's on that list?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Thank you, David. Which one?
I know.
So on Halloween, maybe I will dress up as Tenderness. One of my great friends has the admirable gift of every year of her life, she has had to dress up on Halloween as herself. Happy birthday, dear Deborah. So what's on people's hearts, minds, pleasures tonight? Let's see where it goes.
Not a connection, just an observation, maybe you could say more about, between Pierre de Chardin's Sacred Heart practice that his, you know, he was raised in his family on, and Gurdjieff's, you know, growing up in the Eastern Orthodox Church with the prayer of the heart, would have been part of his, in his vocabulary, chanting the Tresidion, as we talked about, and dropping the mind into the heart, all that extra rich theology, mystical theology that's in the Eastern Orthodox Church. You know, different modalities, but same connection. And so I found that this, it's kind of a neat thing that I feel like I saw, that both, all of those different spiritual technologies, however you want to think of them, go to the same truth.
Yeah. So. Yeah, great. But we're going to have to dip into that more. Have you made the acquaintance yet, Ben, of the Olga Luchakova article on the essence of prayer of the heart?
The which one?
The essence of prayer of the heart.
Fire.
Yeah, I mentioned it in passing in the blogs I did on the pandemic with regard to the I Am exercise.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, yeah. And it's... It's one of the seminal pieces that we're going to have to tear into. Sorry to drop heavy scholarship off to you after, you know, we've all killed off six bottles of wine. But, we'll see. We said, what's coming up tonight? But in this article, Olga was initiated in a Russian mystical hermetic school into prayer of the heart at the same time that she's had exclusive inner teaching in some of the inner energetic traditions of the Vedanta tradition. So she has a very, very strong grip of the inner technology that undergirds prayer of the heart. And of course, a lot of this has been passed on strictly one-on-one. Not only to, in some sense, guard its secrecy, but more importantly, to guard the safety of the would-be practitioner. Because the prayer works a lot on the junction between centers, particularly the moving and the instinctive center. And you have to have a lot of yourself pretty well under control or under direction before you start messing with it. So the guts of it have already always been taught in oral transmission. You get the outer edge of it in what you can read in books. But she's taken us a little bit further along that path in this article by, first of all, very, very interestingly positioning the Jesus Prayer as a particular specimen of prayer of the heart. Prayer of the heart being the larger category. And I think that's helpful in and of itself, because a lot of people use them as if they're synonymous. She says the Jesus Prayer is the orthodox means of manifesting this deeper practice called prayer of the heart. And in a brilliant way, she rolls it out slowly as a deepening exercise, inquiry, self-inquiry in a relational field in which the finite and the infinite, the boundaried and the unboundaried, come into a mutual dialogue and begin to change places. So it takes place on the cusp of the me, my small self, in relationship with this bigger self, this name of God that I named. And gradually they begin, the poles of identity get flying around until finally the subject-object dichotomy collapses. And you find yourself right at the headwaters where form emerges nanosecond by nanosecond out of the formless, but always within a relational field, so that you're not doing the I am going into my innermost depth, but in the context of a dialogue between you as a finite form and the infinite yearning to pour itself into form. You understand something about the arising of the wellspring out of the unboundary. It's a brilliant article. And she looks at the technology in the chest in very profound ways. So it's an interesting guide, but it creates in its own way a deep resonance between Lord have mercy and the I am. And that resonance reverberates quietly through the whole prayer of the heart, Lord have mercy tradition in the Gurdjieff work, and carries it some of its mystical depth, probably the heart of its mystical depth. And as you come to discover in yourself the unbreakable connection between I am and Lord have mercy, you've actually, I think you've accessed the ground, the sacred ground out of which this teaching, this vision, actually emerges. So there's many, many ways we can work with this, and I just have no confidence at the moment that I have either the skill or the authorization to break into it. The exercises we've been working at for the past couple days that Deborah has led us into, as we begin to learn to work with the Gospodi Pobili on our, you know, after the body has been brought into sensation, after we've begun to engage the specific sensation of a specific part of the body with our attention, after we've resonated the words, these are all profound ground in the work for beginning to do it. The classic prayer of the heart traditions, which you can read between the pages of the Philokalia and work with a little, has to do with beginning to invite sensation in the chest and in the place, the Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, and that. We've worked with them too. But this is a very rich pool of exploration and transformation that at some point we'll dive into more fully. As I say, I really don't feel at this point ready to even kind of be the traffic director for such an exploration. But I know it's there, and that it'll find us if it's on the plate. I do think that Teilhard bumped into it by accident, mm-hmm. you know, without knowing exactly what he was doing. You know, his early recitation of the sacred, you know, the devotions of the Sacred Heart was placed in his heart because he felt the energy there, the fire there. And I think that that rewired him and is really the ground for his dawning capacity for the a-perspectival perception. I don't think we can get such perspective until we really have our identity grounded more deeply in our heart. You know, that the mind is never going to be seeing, is going to be able to see in that depth of perspective. You know, that, and the classic Orthodox traditions encapsulated in the word heart, the essence of what the Gurdjieff tradition encapsulates in three-centered awareness. So they're very, very strong parallels. But what for me is a really, really interesting question, which I'm still, you know, leading into, is that Gurdjieff himself, who would certainly have been saturated with the tradition of the prayer of the heart, virtually never uses the word heart in his teaching. And the emotional center is definitely not the heart. He would have easily have equated the two if he could have. So he's seeing, you know, the question is, what is the heart for Gurdjieff? And how does this relate to the teachings of the heart as received in the traditions? I think these are fascinating questions. Joseph Aziz is beginning to pry into those. I don't know whether he swears he knows more. But, you know, we've yet to have that conversation. But he did get some instruction from the monks at Athos that people that are gender challenged like me would never get. So we'll see. I mean, this is a very, very, very living area of inquiry once we really give each other and ourselves permission to dive into it. So just to affirm that, yeah, you've got a tiger by the tail, Ben, and keep swinging.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Cynthia? This is from Beelzebub. And concerning this, he once said as follows. This is the most very saintly Ashiyashimash. The factors for the being impulse conscience arise in the presences of the three brain beings from the localization of the particles of the emanations of the sorrow of our omni-loving and long-suffering endless creator. That is why the source of the manifestation of genuine conscience in three-centered beings is sometimes called the representative of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And the word represent is used in the exercises. And I'm curious about represent, or what, do you have any comments on the use of that word?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't want to say that the representative of the
creator
and represent in the text are the same word. I mean, I'd really want to go back and look at the translations to see what they do before we just jump there. That being said, this idea, this word represent to yourself, that your right arm is Mecca. You know, represent to yourself that you are in an atmosphere that surrounds you on all sides to the extent of about a meter. This represent is a very, very interesting and delicate notion to wrap your being around. It doesn't mean visualize. Visualize is too heavy and it's too one-centered. It's a much more gentle and elusive representing something to yourself is sort of the place where sensing meets the imaginal realm. That it's not carried by trying to picture to yourself. When you're picturing Mecca, you don't think about monks and whirling dervishes and try and pull into your imagination to get a picture. But a sense, you sense into it as far as you can, and then invite a more subtle awareness in you to kick in, which really, essentially, invites this other that you've represented to make itself present to you. And if you watch really carefully, you can see the energy shifting so that you're not pushing it around with that kind of forced quality of visualization. That it's funny, you say, oh, come Mecca, and Mecca comes. And if you can be really, really quiet and not mess around with it, with your mind, but still hold it in that field of your sensed attention, something of it will fill in like a kind of peripheral vision, and you'll know it's engaged you. And I asked Joseph about that a couple of weeks ago in a conversation, and I asked him, what does represent mean to you? And we were more or less on the same page about that, but his first thing is notice that at the root of that is the word present, you know. He says, and don't lose track of that. That it's a way of bringing yourself into a sort of more intense presence, or a presence at a different level, in which a more permeable sort of interactive communicative intelligence can take place. Does that make sense at all?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How does that set with those of you who have worked with representing? For Amy, Deborah, anybody else? Matt? Bill, you have some opinion on that?
No, I didn't have it, just to say, I mean, I've worked with it. The thought that came up to it, to my mind was, there's something about it that I want to use the word partial.
Mm-hmm.
There's when you represent something, it's like a part of from mm-hmm. almost another dimension that appears. So it's not a it's not visual.
Yeah.
But it's the and maybe the idea of conscience being a representative is also. It's a part. It's got that same quality.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that it's sort of a term that returns us to a timeless nature that we can access something that is not held in the linear.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if we could just start with a different idea that the universe is essentially joyful to communicate with us. Mm. You know, it's not sitting there playing hard to get. You know, it's just that we are so damn stubborn and clumsy that we ride right by the invitations to engage.
My experience has been it's almost like coinciding mm-hmm. with something provided.
Yeah. Yes.
Brilliant.
Thank you. Coinciding with something provided.
That's really
yeah. Beautiful. That dimension of coinciding is lovely. Because it is. And we can bring ourselves into sync with it as we stop trying to push it around. Thank you. Thank you.
When Gurdjieff uses representative of God, he's using essentially Quranic or Sufi language, the concept that the human being is the Khalifa, the representative of God.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
I think he's intentionally playing off that Dervish language.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was actually groping for. It's the Caliph of God. Is actually how I've heard it before.
Yeah, this piece. Yeah. That piece.
Yeah, that's great. You know. So tell us a little bit more about caliphs and what they do. You know enough about that culture?
A caliph is a representative. So a sheikh will appoint a khalifa who is their representative. So they can initiate people into the path on behalf of the sheikh. And the human being who has balanced the 99 names of God within themselves becomes the representative of the divine on earth. And so that's the capacity of the human being who activates the names within themselves.
Yeah.
They represent the divine in this realm. So.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, that's a lovely way of looking at it. And of course, in the classic theology with which priesthood first began to delineate itself from bishops in the church, a priest was a representative of the bishop. In exactly that way. You are an extension of the, you know, another hand of the bishop. You know, rather than this is another separate order. So it's occurred to me that we ought to write a letter to the president and say we've just formed here a new House of Representatives. And David's given us the name of God we choose. And, it's all coming together swimmingly. are we having fun yet?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Good. That Khalifat, is exactly the right. That's what we were, that's exactly the resonance in which this is working. It's almost like something is installed in our heart, which belongs to that divine heart and activates that and guards it within our being.
That kind of puts me in mind of Panikkar's, I'm one with the source, and so far as I too act as the source by making everything I receive flow again.
Yeah. Did everybody hear that? Say it as if you meant it, Thomas.
I am one with the source insofar as I too act as the source by making everything I have received flow again.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. That flowing representation. So it flows out for you. And conscience, understood in this way, the light within, will keep an eye on you. And will, if you invite it to, we'll let you know when you're, as the Quakers used to say, out of the light. And one of the really, really painful aspects of really working with this along the Quaker path is that your realization that you're out of the light comes almost instantaneously. Once you sensitize to this, you know. But you don't know why you're out of the light. And you don't want to admit that the thing that you're hanging on to so desperately is the thing that's throwing you out of the light. So you struggle for a while to try and run through all your excuses. And it's only when you finally get to the bottom of that, you say, well, it's simple. Here it is. Not easy, but simple. And in the Quaker path, progress is really measured quite quantitatively with the ability to stay in the light, which again doesn't mean to always be happy and peaceful. It means to listen promptly to the voice of conscience as it manifests in you and to make course adjustments accordingly. And as that is adopted as a practice, the more consistent and pure that becomes, the faster and more powerfully you gain stability in your path and become a real active ingredient or really beacon of conscience. There's a wonderful story about, I think it was the Pennington family, Isaac Pennington and his wife, and his wife particularly had money. And they were part of the English gentry, and the Quakers were by and large not of the noble-born caste, and were looked upon with horror because of their lack of respect for the mores of the upper classes. So when Isaac and Mrs. Pennington, I can't remember, Mary Pennington, I think her name was, began their Quaker journey, it quickly came to Mary's attention that her finery, you know, that she wore just beautifully as part of her dress, as part of her position in the gentry of England at the time, was out of the light. And you know, these things are fiercely particular. Just because it's out of the light for Mary Pennington doesn't mean that it would be out of the light for Rebecca Parker. You're off the hook, my dear. But on the other hand, you know it, you know, in your conscience. She began to realize that as her growing commitment to Quakerism was filling in, that this sort of habitual, you know, wearing these most stylish wardrobes was neither necessary nor consistent with the values that she was now taking to heart. And she got rid of them. Endured several days in prison as the price of this from her shocked colleagues. But this is what it means, that it very, very gently at first sneaks up on you and does a test case to see how promptly some sort of small behavior, you'd say, well, that's just my foible, you know. I've worked a good hard day, you know, I think I'll do this thing. And it, little by little, it turns the screw on you until you realize that the question's been called. And that maybe yesterday it wasn't an issue of conscience, but today it is. That's how the light shows and discovers in us. And depending on how we handle these tests, you know, many of us, myself at the head of the pack, do it by saying, oh, that's interesting. This is this interesting thing I've developed when I'm in the spiritual side of me. You know, I now see how the light is showing little inconsistencies in my conscience, but hey, it's 5 minutes of five, and at five I'm in the other half of myself. Hi! Is this just me? What kind of idiots are they? Transparent idiots. But anyway, that's how it works. And it's a gentle game, but once you start really playing it, things move quickly. Once you really decide that you're going to take that seriously and be in relationship with it, it's the quickest path I know to profound transformation in your life, and it's totally customized. It's just you. It's where you are out of the light, not where Joan or Bob is out of the light. And it will be presented in an order very specific to your particular fixations and evasions. And it always presents itself in a way that you can disregard it gently. And nothing is lost, evidently. It's a precious, precious opportunities in your life. to actually transmit and transform something of a different order. I do know that every time I've pushed myself and taken up the invitation from that which shows and discovers, there's initial struggle and pain, and such an infusion of confirmation and energy and redirection on the other side that I wonder why I hesitated until the next time comes around. Then I know why I hesitated. but you see, I mean, everybody's waiting to be enlightened by somebody else. And really, it lies right there at your feet. The caliph is inside, awaiting only for you to listen and to follow. Obey means listen deeply. Talking to myself. What else?
I have a question.
I don't know
how to completely ask, but I think it's being asked, and I'm trying to put language to it. It seems like in working with the atmosphere and working with the prayer of the heart or the concentrated attention, there's a point where it can become very concentrated and then expand very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the word that comes to mind is in expansion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could say more about what Teilhard or your own perspective on that. I think it was centration.
Mm-hmm.
And just that dynamic of, because I think what Ben brought up and what others have mentioned, I feel like we're on a cusp of, you know, you've written about it.
Yeah.
And other blessings as well, but this kind of invitation to that concentrated point of attention that can...
Yeah.
That's
perfectly true.
Yeah.
And I think you're likening that to centration. I think that's exactly what Teilhard means. And when he describes in the Christic how becoming more and more concentrated in the region of his chest around the heart, and all of a sudden there's this explosion of the radiant Christ out from it. And I think that's a path that many have discovered in their life. The thing I'd want to say, particularly to people whose psyche and whose perceptions tend to be on the intent side, is to ground your whole being. That there is a very, very beautiful and wise passage towards the end of Meditations on the Tarot, where Valentine Thomberg is pondering, I think it's page 574, but don't quote me. The Holy Spirit is not in the business of destroying us with intensity. And that the grace and mercy of life is set up so that everything works best for everybody if we can assimilate the intensities that we experience. And then bear them forth into the world as a healthy and integrated radiation. That the path of supercentration, of concentrating instancy, can lead to very, very rapid implosion, explosion. No doubt about it. And the real question is it going to blow your whole psychic structure to smithereens? Or have you created something that can hold it? And a lot of the work of the lower sitters, particularly the work of grounding the body in movement, all helps to build a center that can hold it, and an outer skeleton that can distribute it in ways that are not psychotic or crazy or intense, but remain inviting for people and gentle. So sometimes it's a work of not pushing the button when you know where the button is, because it needs a little bit more space and time around it so that it flows and matures into a beautifully incarnate plant. So as with everything in the spiritual life, it's a balancing act. You know, and the instructions that are specific to one person and one type may not be specific to another. It's why so much of spiritual direction in the classic sense was really done one-on-one in private sessions and not in groups and not online and things, because you have to always be measuring counsel against the particular way in which the person who's come with a question is going to be able to receive it. And for many who tend anyway to be on the dull side of sleep, you know, to concentrate energy is a profound way to wake up and blast out. For others, it's you know, it's a moth to flame. And you have to know where you are in that and resist moth to flame if it screams a little bit too intensely. You know, and I say that to you really specifically, Jonathan, because I know from if I didn't know before, I certainly knew from how you responded to the Thomas Keating poems in the Secret Embrace course we do, that you track this completely. You track it right back to the origin, and you have ways of seeing it and saying it that came out even in your naming of us tonight. That come from the gift of a pellucid wisdom that doesn't arise in this world. And your task as a human being is going to be to learn how to manage that in a way that's mature and flowing and efficacious without losing it. It's a good challenge. Yeah, it's a good challenge, but it's a good gift too, and you'll be protected. But for you, notice that, play with it, but, you know, don't get yourself trapped in it until you really, really know that you can go right through it and emerge out the other end, still with the pieces together. Anybody want to know how to mow a lawn or clean their navel?
Oh, man.
What?
I don't know.
Are you about to implode again, Tim? With her, it's three times a day.
And you saying tonight that he doesn't use the word heart explicitly much at all in the teaching. Mm-hmm. And when you said the Caliph is inside you, you placed your hand right over your heart as you said that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've been working with objective conscience, it seems to me, at least in my experience, that it resides physically in the heart,
mm-hmm.
objective conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And that when I anchor awareness physically in my heart center, it becomes physically impossible to speak or act in ways that are reactive, defensive, or egoic. Like I can't, as long as awareness is anchored there, I can't say something from a place of venom or vanity or selfishness, but the minute awareness is allowed to shift out of there and move up into the head, then I can have a bite again or I can, you know,
mm-hmm.
but as long as I keep awareness grounded there, I physically, I'm in resonance, and my heart tells me if this is in integrity and alignment or not. You just know immediately, and the only way to avoid that is to put awareness somewhere else. So I wonder what your sense of the relationship between objective conscience and this physical heart bandwidth would be.
Yeah. My own sense is that there is something very precious and crucial about the region, you know, if not just the physical heart, the immediate field around it. But this needs to be grounded in the body from lower down as well. Because otherwise it has a little bit too delicate of a fragrance. And when you talk about not being able, when you're in heart awareness, you can't express venom and, you know, meanness.
You can chop, but it's not from a place of meanness.
Yeah, exactly. But these elemental elements are in people as well. And what very often happens is that they can be held and in a sense assimilated and regulated from a deeper place where the fire and the ferocity exist as well. And but if you don't allow your structure to really incorporate more than the heart, then you're going to tend to box yourself into positivity. And then you've got a loose cannon in your being. And it's going to leak out in other ways. You know, either in indirect cynicism or in lack of vitality. That there is something that is held in the solar plexus, something that's held in the belly, something that's held in the genitals, that are crucially important to allowing the heart to function fully supported as that structure which you're thinking. So I'd say that you're on to the essence of the revelation, but the continuing work to give it legs in the world will reap rewards in terms of your coming into increasing direct contact with a fiery strength in yourself, which is also not mean, but is needed for action. The journey continues, you know. I suspect myself, and I don't know, I'd really love to be in dialogue about this with people that have worked in the world, that or worked in the work for a long time, that Gurdjieff really reserved the heart, the term heart, to refer to the higher emotional center, so that it basically touched base with the physical heart. But it became a seed of conscience that was deeply clean and that had transformed and in a sense transfigured the work of the emotional center in a deeper and more profoundly integrated reality, again resting on the work of all three centers. And only then can you speak about heart and where it actually resonates. You know, it may indeed be here, but it's less tied to a specific physical region. You know, it goes out way beyond there. But this is a huge inquiry, and if we can really just sort of open up the fields to the devotional and mystical underpinnings of this teaching, I think we may be able to, together as newfound seekers of the truth, discover where some of this teaching actually lodges. Anything else in people's hearts and minds? I want to allow some space tonight so that if some of you are hoping to sort of drift into smaller groups to converse with each other a little bit or before the evening ends, that there's plenty of space for that. We've done some work tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to look a little bit. I'm going to come back and visit the chapter on the Conscious Circle of Humanity. And thanks, David, for giving us a first run-up on it. And then try to talk about the situation really specifically on our plate in the next two weeks and 2 months as we head back into a world which has been changing under our feet even this week. And sort of begin to ponder together where this, whatever work was struck here this week, which is actually reverberating out in the world as some sort of stillness or calm, wants to take us and hold us, particularly through the eye of the needle of next week. So we'll have some reflection on that. So let's close with Agios O Theos. And if any of you know hand positions or movement positions, you're welcome to do so. Again, as these words of the music reverberate around it, see if you can get beyond that we're just doing a little final performance together, and see if you can go back to the source of these words, the reverberation of them, the stream of yearning that still flows through them, the connection with the heart of Mr. Gurdjieff. And our own very deep need in the planet at this time for one who is firm and undying. Agios O Theos, Agios
Agios O Theos.
So it seems fitting to end with the three vows again, the three rakus. The first vow. To my own striving, to that which brings me here and brings me back. The second bow to the work of the group, which carries us collectively to where we could never go individually. The second bow. The third bow to the great work, in which you're honored to share our own tiny slice of participation. Third bow. With blessings to all.